Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
President Obama's campaign co-chair switches teams from campaign to super PAC. The part-time jobs that pay up to $200,000 a year, and how that little at sign in email addresses almost got deleted forever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, September 5th. Glad to have you with us. If we needed any more confirmation that super PACs have moved front and center in this year's presidential race, well, we got it today. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel is leaving his post as national co-chair of the Obama campaign to raise big money for a pro-Obama super PAC. Rahm Emanuel's known to be a pretty good fundraiser, and the Democrats need some help in that arena this year. They've slipped far behind their Republican rivals when it comes to super PAC donations, Marketplace's Bob Moon reports.
The Democrats are fully embracing the super PACs now that they're scrambling to catch up on big money donations. The Sunlight Foundation's Liz Bartolomeo has been tracking fundraising activities at both conventions. She says the Democrats headed into their gathering trying to avoid the appearance of courting big money.
They've always been resistant to the super PACs. They've been a little hesitant to play the game.
But now the former White House chief of staff himself will be pitching for Priorities USA Action. Bartolomeo says that group hosted a big money reception last night and reported it's been making progress, raising $10 million in the past month.
That puts them still very, very far behind what the Republicans have. One of the Republican super PACs, Restore Our Future, has over $85 million as of the end of July, whereas Priorities USA Action only had about $25 million.
She says the push is now clearly on at the Democratic Convention with a series of so-called Super Orama events sponsored by the super PACs. They include a Foo Fighters concert tonight and a brunch for Democratic lawmakers held today by billionaire hedge fund investor Jim Simmons. Charles Lewis is the founder of the Center for Public Integrity. He says gatherings like that and in the box seats overlooking the arena haven't gotten the attention they should.
Most conventioneers are not even invited to some of these parties and these fancy receptions and these skyboxes. This is really for billionaires only.
Former Clinton administration advisor Lanny Davis complains the emphasis on the super PACs and their role in funding negative ads has only alienated American voters. And he says all the spending has only led Mr. Obama and Mr. Romney to a draw in the public opinion polls.
What's the gap between them? Nothing. Who's ahead? Nobody.
In the end, he says, who wins will ultimately come down to the candidate who talks about what the American people care about. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
So you may have heard this kind of thing the last week or so. Ann Romney's trending. Michelle Obama's trending. Those two ladies have been hot topics of conversation on Twitter. Trending usually happens when a whole bunch of people decide to weigh in on a topic, like Clint Eastwood and the empty chair. Other people pay to have their topic featured in Twitter's trend window. Either way, just what is the value of trending? Marketplace's Mark Garrison takes a look.
Pay Twitter enough and they'll make sure your message trends all the way to the top. Today, the right-leaning 501c4 Americans for Prosperity paid to boost the hashtag failing agenda, hoping that would get people talking about their critique of President Obama's policies. Buying Twitter trends has been popular this campaign season.
It's definitely pretty powerful.
Online marketing consultant Brian Eisenberg says it's a tool to rise above all the competing noise.
To break through the clutter in any way you can, even if it's for a fleeting moment.
Twitter is banking on this. Selling promoted tweets and trends is one way it hopes to solve the problem a lot of big social media companies have. Lots of users and buzz, not so much money coming in. But Twitter can't control what happens to trends it sells. Jeff Dachis is a social marketing strategist.
You could have an equal number of people on the other side of that message utilizing that same hashtag.
And indeed, a lot of Obama supporters turned today's failing agenda hashtag around into an indictment of Republican ideas. Project for Excellence in Journalism director Tom Rosensteel.
It's a little bit like being in a bar and seeing a TV ad come on, and if somebody bellows that the ad's a bad ad and everybody laughs, that ad could really backfire on you. It could be not a form of persuasion, but a form of ridicule.
But in any case, tens of millions of Americans don't use Twitter at all. If Twitter passion won elections, Ron Paul would be the Republican nominee. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
No clear trending on Wall Street today. Details when we do the numbers. Unemployment still hovering around 8% in many parts of the country. Now, that sounds high to most of us, but to people in a lot of small towns all over America, that's life. Yunis, New Mexico was one of those towns. It's located in the dusty southeast corner of the state, far away from cities like Santa Fe or Albuquerque. A few years ago, town leaders in Yunis decided to entice a nuclear processing plant, hoping to create new jobs. As part of our Burn series on energy, Loretta Williams reports on how nuclear has been working out for that small town.
To understand how a nuclear facility came to rest at this far edge of the High Plains, you first have to understand what else is here. Hear that sound? That's the rhythmic squeak of a horsehead oil pump. There's a pump jack every few blocks in Yunis, and thousands more stretching east, all the way past Odessa, Texas.
Our economy here has always been based some on ranching, not a lot, but more on the oil industry once it became started.
That's Matt White, the silver-haired mayor of Yunis.
Oil market goes down, guess what? Our economy tanks. Goes back up, we do great.
This corner of New Mexico is littered with the ghost of oil towns gone bust. 12 years ago, Yunis seemed headed in that same direction. Over the decades, the population slid from 6,000 to about 2,500. Town leaders decided they needed to do something to get off the oil market roller coaster. At the same time, Urenco, a European company, was looking for a place to build a nuclear enrichment plant in the United States. Urenco first tried towns in Louisiana, then Tennessee, but those communities worried about potential disaster. Yunis, however, saw opportunity.
Hi. Mr. White?
Yes.
Hi.
Barbershop owner Lynn White and his customer John Aylesworth welcome the nuclear facility because it would mean jobs not tied to oil and boost local business. Aylesworth thinks the other towns let their fear get in the way of a good thing.
Nuclear energy, in my opinion, is one of the safest forms of energy there is. There's less accidents than any other one you can name. And why people are afraid of it is beyond me. It don't make sense.
But when you mention the word nuclear, we go back to Three Mile Island. Everybody, oh,
well,
I couldn't do this.
It. That's the problem. People don't understand it. They think it's real danger. It's going to kill everybody.
A nuclear enrichment facility is not as dangerous as a nuclear power plant. It's one step in the production of nuclear fuel rods. Still, it does work with uranium. Steve Cowan is Urenco's head of operations.
Most of the power plants in the world use a light water reactor, with uranium-235 as the primary constituent in the fissioning process.
Fission is the nuclear reaction that releases energy. But there's less than 1% of U-235 in the processed material called raw uranium. The enrichment facility takes the material and increases the U-235 to 3-5%, the range most commercial power plants require.
When we're done with it, we take the uranium hexafluoride that we've enriched, and we ship it to the fuel fabricators. They turn it into fuel pellets and put them into the fuel rods, and then they ship them to the nuclear power plants.
Cowan says about 350 employees operate the plant, and there are as many as 1,000 construction-related jobs. Between Urenco and the current oil boom, the unemployment rate in the county around Eunice hovers at 4%, half the national average. The population has surged, and new restaurants and businesses are opening on Main Street. Not everyone is comfortable with the nuclear plant, of course, and the true test of the economy won't come until the oil boom ends. But Mayor White says he likes where things are headed.
As a mayor, I know we need to grow as a town. If you don't have growth, you're going to die over the long play. You've got to keep moving.
I'm Loretta Williams for Marketplace.
Loretta's report is part of the series Burn, an Energy Journal. It's from Sound Vision Productions and produced in association with APM. Special thanks to the National Science Foundation. Thousands of teachers are not heading back to school this week. Budget cuts have hit one of the country's largest professions especially hard. In the last 3 years, more than 300,000 education jobs have disappeared. And that's left a lot of people working on their Plan B. Former technology teacher Chris Bulin found his at the airport.
I was working as a teacher in the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And I got called down to the principal's office one day between classes, and he said, well, I'm sorry to do this, but you know, we've had some budget problems, and so we're going to have to let you and all the part-time teachers go. I did look for other teaching jobs. After about a year of really trying and seeing how frustrating it was time to, you know, open up the horizon. One day while flying out of the San Francisco airport, I saw the SFO Airport Museum. I got on their website and thought, well, maybe I could do something with them. So I wrote them a letter, and then it just went from there that I got hired on as a part-time person, and that's where I'm at right now. I'm earning less than I was as a teacher, a lot less. But, you know, you do what you can to survive. What I miss is working with the kids. I miss seeing that smile on their face when they get something and saying, hey, I contributed to this, and this person is going to go on and do good things, and I helped with that. I'm married, and so we live on double income, but no, it's not a job that would allow me to pay all my bills. One of the nice things about it, which was a little bit different than teaching, is people treat me with respect, and they want to know what I know. They value what skills I have, and I'm not afraid to go to work. I'm not afraid to say, hey, I don't know how to do something. Everybody's there on the same side.
Thanks to Amy Scott for producing this piece. For more tales of teachers after teaching, go to marketplace.org. Coming up,
for centuries, it's had a very sort of pedestrian, perfunctory, and essential role in commerce.
The story behind that little at symbol, long before the days of Twitter and email. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street drifted up and down today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points, or 0.1%, to close at 13,047. The Nasdaq gave back 5 points, 0.2%, to finish at 3069. The S&P 500 slipped 1 point, 0.1%, to end the day at 1403. Investors appeared cautious a day before the European Central Bank meets to consider the next steps in the debt crisis there. Facebook finally caught a break. Its shares rose 4.8% a day after the social network scrapped a plan to sell additional shares and announced that founder Mark Zuckerberg would not sell any personal shares for a year. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.59%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. President Obama is scheduled to speak at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. Solutions to the age-old problem, I've got nothing to wear, are finally revealed. Future trends hit New York City catwalks during Fashion Week, getting underway tomorrow. And the Marion Popcorn Festival gets poppin' in Marion, Ohio. Crafts, a parade, pageants, and popcorn. My favorite food. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ryssdal. Greece will be hosting its least welcome visitors in Athens this week. Once again, the debt inspectors will be in town. Officials from the European Union and the International Monetary Fund will check out the government's books to see whether the Greeks are complying with the terms of their second bailout. Word is, the inspectors will pile on the pressure and make the terms of that bailout even tougher. From the Marketplace European desk, Stephen Beard reports.
This could be the last straw. The EU and the IMF are reported to be pressing Greece to further reform its labour laws and permit a six-day working week. In Athens, commentator John Serapalis says, in a country with more than 20% unemployed, that demand will be widely seen as insulting.
That may produce a severe political backlash, and the streets of Athens could become quite violent and ugly again very quickly.
And he says if these tougher terms are on the table, they will add to the sense in Greece that the country really isn't wanted in the Eurozone.
People no longer consider that Greece's being thrown out of the Euro is out of the question. I think it is now considered to be a political and economic and legal possibility.
In London's financial centre, in some quarters, a Greek exit or Grexit is considered a probability. Louise Cooper is a market analyst with the money brokers BCG.
The big question is, how quickly will the IMF and the European Union cut Greece loose?
But she admits the consequences of Grexit are unpredictable. It could lead to the unravelling of the euro. For that reason, Professor Nairu Woods, an Oxford University economist, doesn't believe it's going to happen.
Nobody can afford this to come to a head. The costs will be enormous for everyone in the European Union.
So she thinks the can will again be kicked further down the road. But after 2.5 years of crisis, can the can take another kicking? In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Speaking of kicking, football fans rejoice. Tonight, the 2012 NFL season begins. It's the Cowboys versus the Giants, and the players, the coaches, the hot dog vendors, they're all ready to get back to work. Except for the referees. Those guys in the pinstripe shirts tonight will be last-minute replacements. They'll be standing in for the league's regular officials because of a contract dispute, fighting the league over a plan to eliminate their pensions, among other things. And that got us wondering, all that running back and forth, blowing those whistles, getting shouted at by angry coaches and players, what do NFL refs get in return? We asked Doug Tribou from WBUR in Boston to find out.
For a long time, Bill Carollo's business attire was a striped suit.
I worked 20 years in the NFL, primarily as a head referee.
Today, Carollo oversees the officials for four Division I college football conferences. He retired from the NFL after the 2009 season.
The average official will spend about 25 hours a week on football. If you're a head referee, he's more like 30 to 35 hours.
Under the last contract, rookies made more than $75,000. Senior refs could bring in almost $200,000. That's about half of what officials in other major pro sports make, and NFL refs are part-time.
These referees are almost like submarine workers. They're in the bunker for those 6 months, and then they're free for those other 6 months.
Andrew Brandt is ESPN's NFL business analyst and former vice president of the Green Bay Packers.
So the question has to be, what kind of job will allow that complete flexibility?
For Bill Carollo, that meant holding down some small side jobs. Well, not so small. First, he was an international account executive for IBM and later a vice president at the job placement firm Manpower. He says most of the 119 NFL refs have a second job, but regardless of what they do off the field, one thing never changes.
Sunday afternoon at kickoff, for those 3 hours, it's beautiful.
But for now, at least, regular NFL officials will be at home, waiting to see if their replacements are up to the task. I'm Doug Tribou for Marketplace.
The last 2 weeks, the news has really been dominated by the conventions. But Marketplace's David Gura has been stepping back from all the theater and the politics, traveling the back roads of both Florida and North Carolina as part of our coverage of the things that will really matter this fall, the real economy, we call it. David recently spent time in Martin County in the eastern part of North Carolina. That's where he found a farmer who says his success is closely tied to immigration.
I started my interview with Taylor Slade the same way I start every interview.
Let me just have you say your name and your title, and I'll get a level on you.
I don't have a title, David. I'm just Taylor Slade, poor dirt farmer. That's my title. Debt holder.
He's exaggerating. Slade owns more than 3,000 acres of farmland, and his family's been in this area for a long time. The first Slade got here almost three centuries ago from England.
My ancestor, probably the sheriff, was chasing him, and he was trying to get away, and he ran down to the dock, and there was a ship pulling out, and it was either go overboard, get arrested, or jump on the ship, and he got on the ship, and this is where he wound up.
This is a part of North Carolina with a lot of agriculture. I get in Slade's silver pickup, and we pass fields full of tobacco and peanuts. But cotton is still king here, even if the market's changed. Slade tells me that today 95% of all the cotton produced in the U.S. goes overseas. Slade takes me to one of his fields and he explains how the cotton plant blooms. The flowers start out white, then they turn a pale pink.
Here is a, right there, pretty magenta bloom, you see. That's the third day. This is the bowl, right here.
He points to a little green sphere that later this month will split open into a tuft of white fiber. And eventually Slade will take it and hundreds of thousands like it to the local cotton gin to be cleaned.
Well, that turned.
There we go. Local cotton gin in this case is Roanoke Tar Cotton Incorporated, which Slade happens to own and operate. It's a business he started back in 1991, a giant maze of machines designed to pick and comb through cotton.
Right here, this machine has 198 saws. Put your hand right in there.
3 weeks from now, Slade will be gearing up for ginning season. He'll hire a staff of 65 workers. And 2 months ahead of the election, he's thinking about each and every one of them.
And I'll be very honest with you. Our labor force here is Hispanic.
They're mostly migrant workers who show up just before the start of ginning season. Immigration reform is a big priority for Slade. Most North Carolinians tend to have a pretty balanced view of immigration, Kenneth Fernandez says. He directs the Elon University poll.
Being a state that has a large agricultural industry, I think there's a lot of people in the business and people who know people that are in the agriculture business that know that this industry relies on immigrant labor.
For his part, Slade has hired hundreds of immigrants over the years, and he thinks they deserve a chance to achieve the American dream.
We need to address our non-resident workforce. And these people came to America, whether they came legally or not, they came to America and they contributed. They went to work.
Slade supports President Obama's decision to allow children of immigrants who came here illegally to apply for deferred action against deportation.
Those young people can become productive citizens without constantly looking over their shoulder. I think this is a great thing.
Today, just about 9% of North Carolina's population is Hispanic. In Martin County, it's about 3%, but it's growing. Slade calls himself an optimist. All farmers are, he tells me. And he's hopeful politicians will take up immigration reform soon. Meanwhile, North Carolina still has a ways to go. The unemployment rate here is 9.4%. But Slade says President Obama deserves credit for trying to shore up the economy.
The American public chose for a change in the last election, and they chose a good man. And it'll be in November when we'll decide if the American public thinks that their choice was the right choice from last time.
In Martin County, North Carolina, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
It's a symbol we use perhaps dozens of times a day, depending on how many emails or tweets we send. It's that little at symbol that sits right above the number 2 on our keyboards. Well, ever wonder where it came from and how it got so popular? William Allman can tell you. He's chief digital officer at Smithsonian Enterprises, and he's written an article all about that little symbol. Mr. Allman, welcome.
Thank you.
So do we know where the at symbol came from?
Sure. I mean, for centuries, it's had a very sort of
pedestrian, perfunctory, and essential role in commerce. If you're buying 12 widgets at a dollar, it's $12, not 12 widgets for a dollar.
Right.
And so the ad sign has been used that way for hundreds of years.
Now, I understand that the earliest typewriters, though, didn't have the at symbol. So had it almost gone extinct, the way of the cent sign?
Exactly. And it was threatened because, of course, the first typewriters were these clunky mechanical things. Space was very scarce. And so they had to decide which symbols do we want to put on there. And the at didn't make the cut. You can still find typewriters without the at sign on, just as now if you have to hunt to find one that has the cent sign on it.
So how did the at symbol then make such a dramatic comeback?
Well, part of its success was, in fact, because of its relative obscurity. There was a fellow named Ray Tomlinson, and he was trying to solve a problem. He wanted to be able to communicate with other researchers who are connected to other computers. His big challenge was, how do I identify that person on that computer, and how do I identify myself on my computer, since there could have been dozens or hundreds of people on each computer?
Right.
So he had a name, and he had a computer, and he had to find a way to link them together, and his eyes fell on his keyboard and said, well, what should I use? Well, at the time, all the other symbols, or many of the other symbols, were being used in computer programming already. So to insert a different symbol would have caused a problem. The computer would have misunderstood it. So he picked the most obscure one he could see, which was the at sign.
You know, we just call it the at symbol, and it's such a boring name. And you have pointed out that in other countries, there are much more descriptive terms for that little symbol.
That's absolutely right. It's called the snail by the Italians. It's called the monkey tail by the Dutch. Most of us cyber people call it just the at sign, and most of us in English call it the at sign. But it's amazing because it's gone from this being one of the most obscure symbols in the lexicon to this rock star of communication.
William Allman wrote the article, The Accidental History of the At Symbol. It's in this month's issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Mr. Allman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you want to find out what the Poles or the Greeks or the Israelis call the at symbol, go to our website, marketplace.org. One of them calls it strudel.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally, we wish we'd been sitting in the courtroom for this one. New York's highest court today heard arguments from the owners of a New York strip club. They're arguing they shouldn't have to pay sales taxes on nude lap dances because they're a tax-exempt art, just like a ballet performance or a play. Lap dancing is a, quote, live dramatic or musical arts performance under New York state tax laws, in their view. And their expert witness, a cultural anthropologist who studies exotic dance. Hold on to your seats for that decision. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 11 points, or 0.1%, to close at 13,047. The NASDAQ fell 5 points, 0.2%, to finish at 3069. And the S&P 500 slipped 0.1% to end the day at 1403. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. I'm Sarah Gardner. Hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.